books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I'm joined by author and poet Elspeth Wilson to chat about her debut novel, These Mortal Bodies. Plus today we'll find a batch of brand new books available from RNIB.
All that and more on today's Read On.
These Mortal Bodies is described as a gripping and atmospheric dark academia novel about toxic female friendships and obsession. I'll chat to author Elspeth Wilson in a moment, but for now, the audio version of the book is read by Kirsty Isla McIntyre.
It's too late. I know it, but I try anyway. I have the same feeling as when you already know you've overslept without even checking your alarm. Except this is so much worse. The comparison seems almost laughable. This isn't like the days we stayed up too late at sleepovers, fueled by sugar and the thrill of doing something forbidden, where we'd have to rush to brush our teeth and still be late for double chemistry. I let the water pool around my ankles, then my knees, then my thighs as I wade in deeper and deeper. I know her body so well, and I look for any sign of it, but I find none. There were footprints on the beach that looked about a size 6, but if I'm honest with myself, I know they could have been anyone's. I know she came here, because she always did. And I know that this time I didn't go with her, and now she hasn't come back.
These Mortal Bodies is a coming-of-age story set in an all-girls college at a prestigious university, and it follows the story of Ivy Graveson for 1 year as she heads off from her Scottish hometown to go to this prestigious university. She's kind of hoping to be able to escape her past. She's had some grief and trauma in her past. Her best friend had died, and she's always been someone who's had this really fervent wish for belonging. And then initially, when she arrives at university, she falls into this really elite world of kind of glitz and glamour and parties and secret societies, which she's really drawn in by. It's very enticing and very seductive. But over the course of the year, she'll start to learn a bit more about the history of her college, the darker underside of the university, and really have to contend with how far she's willing to go to belong.
Other than me, the sea was her closest friend. Just like it's always been for me too. The backdrop to a million selfies and videos, her in front of the camera and me behind it. She would have trusted it. We'd have been happy to play the kind of games with it that we did in drama class, like where you fall backwards into someone's arms because you know they'll catch you. There's no sign of her. A mum and her child play with a bucket and spade further back towards the town, making clumsy castles and studying them in fragments of shell. An oyster catcher leaves its pointed prints in the sand. A dog scuffs its feet, rolling over itself, so that its afterlife is an abstract painting on the ground. For a moment, I close my eyes and listen to the sea, willing it to give up whatever it knows. When I was little, Grandma used to drag me away from the beach where I would cling on to the whispers of the waves, believing they were just for me. I dredge up that connection again, that feeling that the water has something to say to me. But today it tells me nothing of her. I'm too late. It's all my fault.
Now, is there a reason you didn't name it? You just called it an ancient university.
Yeah, so in the book, I think it's really a choice which helped me in terms of craft and writing to have an unnamed university, because obviously if you're contending with places which are as famous as Oxford or Cambridge, which have loads of baggage kind of attached to them, and a lot of people might know them physically or they might kind of have an idea of what they represent, you're going to have to stick a lot more accurately to the place itself. Whereas I really wanted this to be set in an all-girls college, and there aren't really that many all-girls colleges left. There's a couple in Cambridge, but none of them quite had the attributes that I wanted them to. For example, Ivy's College is surrounded by woods. Nature plays a really important part of the novel, and the woods become a really special place to Ivy and her two friends, Martha and Primrose, who are really at the heart of this novel. And because of that, I just felt like it gave me a lot more creative freedom, to be able to explore these different aspects of the setting that I wanted it to have, and kind of be able to turn it this way and that so that it suited the story. And also, I think in doing that, it has let people kind of project what they want onto the book, because the cover has an image of a kind of Gothic building on it. And quite often people will say to me, "Oh, I recognize that building. Like, I know that that's St. Andrews or that's Bath." And actually, it's just a drawing. It's not anywhere. It's not based on a particular building at all. But I think, because it's got that unnamed setting, people will see what they want to see in it.
Yes, St. Andrews came to mind for me, but I guess by making it up, you can put a soaring spire wherever you want.
Exactly.
Now, is Ivy based on anyone, particularly the author?
No, she's not. And I mean, I hope as people read it, obviously I'll avoid spoilers, but that kind of becomes clear why. Because although I have a lot of empathy for Ivy and I like all the characters in the novel, even the ones who do some really bad things, Ivy makes some really ill-advised choices. And because she's so, I guess she's so driven by this desire to belong, and she's had this sense of not quite fitting in and always feeling a bit uncomfortable and never quite doing the right thing, that really compels her to act in ways that, yes, are not very advisable, in ways that we might feel quite strongly about throughout the novel, because she finally finds like she's got this place that she fits, and she wants to kind of do anything to be able to stay there, to secure that status. I guess there's something like there's all something I think about dark academia, which kind of makes the genre, is there's often this outsider status to the protagonist. They let us have this glimpse into these elite worlds while being apart from them, and kind of act as the way into the story for the reader. But no, I happily don't see too much of myself in Ivy, though I guess that would be for other people to judge. But at the same time, I think I was talking with Celia Silvani earlier, who I know who's also been on this podcast talking about her book Baby Teeth, and we were talking about how in all your characters, even the ones that might do some of the kind of most unhinged things that you feel like are just awful, you probably there's always a kind of a fragment of the self in them. And I suppose with Ivy, some of the things that I can relate to her most is that kind of lack of fit. That definitely is something that I could relate to growing up, like feeling like, not quite right for any particular group. And I think I could understand that aspect of Ivy, even if she took that so much further than I ever have, thankfully.
There's a couple of ways that she doesn't fit in, one of which is class. She certainly feels a lot lower class than the rest of our contemporaries at university.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like I would see Ivy as kind of being middle class or lower middle class, and she's had kind of everything provided by her. Like, yeah, she's not had a really lavish upbringing, but she's not lived in poverty either. She's like lived in this perfectly nice home. Like, she's had an okay life from a sort of financial and material perspective. And yet, she is still such a different class from the people that she meets at university, because, they're really coming from the sort of upper classes, some of them even kind of like leaning into the aristocracy. And I think that that is quite a shock for her as a character, because she's kind of got this frame of reference of like going to pubs like Wetherspoons and stuff, which they just sort of like don't have. And I think that's something that I'm quite interested in exploring as well, like the things that kind of seem completely normal in one setting and then give you this kind of fish out of water status in another. And I think Ivy is quite surprised by how much the university she goes to, obviously she is excited by the idea of it kind of having this glitz and glamour, but the extent of that I think surprises her. And she's encountering wealth like she's never seen before, and like I think most of us kind of don't interact with, and yet in some areas of society is so normalized that people are quite surprised when they don't meet someone from that background. And I think that definitely the girls that she ends up becoming friends with don't really understand Ivy, or they can't really understand Ivy. And they're, when there's a part of the novel where they go and visit Ivy's hometown and her parents over Christmas on their Christmas holidays, and I think that Ivy has a sense of being a bit embarrassed about her house, and actually they just kind of see it as really quaint, her friends, and they're like, oh, it's so cute and small and cozy, but they almost don't have the understanding of this class difference between them to even realize that she would feel that they and how she might feel about them making those comments.
Now, another way she doesn't fit in. Well, I've spoken to a very severely sight impaired actor, and he's said that every part is written is implicitly fully sighted and fully abled unless otherwise labelled. Is that the same for your characters? Every character would be neurotypical unless otherwise labelled. Now, Ivy's a bit neurodivergent, but you never actually implicitly say that. Is that a kind of way of a subtler representation?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I'm really interested in. And obviously, I completely appreciate people having different perspectives. And I think the actor you're speaking to, that's a really interesting perspective as well. For me, this is actually something that I wrote about for the bookseller, about what I've called, I guess, for want of a better word, you called it subtle representation. I like that too. I ended up calling it implicit representation because I wasn't quite sure what else to call it. But I definitely did write Ivy as an autistic character, but I feel quite strongly that we shouldn't assume that every character is neurotypical or non-disabled unless we're told otherwise. I think that there's space, obviously, for stories such as I'm thinking of things like A Kind of Spark by Elle MacNicol, which is absolutely amazing and provides so much kind of more explicit representation with themes of neurodiversity very much front and center and driving the story. But I also think that there's space for characters to be neurodivergent or disabled without that necessarily having to be explicitly stated in the text. So I think as well, this is a first person narrative, and I do really don't think Ivy would know that about herself. Like, she's been socialized as a girl, she's been brought up as a young woman, she's kind of done okay at school, she's got into this really good university. I don't think she would have any of the hallmarks that, unfortunately, in a society which still sees neurodiversity in very gendered ways, would have necessarily led to her getting a diagnosis or thinking about herself as autistic. She just has this sense of not feeling quite right, not that she ever kind of like quite fits into any particular group, as I said. And I think because of that, it wouldn't have necessarily felt true to the character to have her have that level of self-knowledge. Like, I certainly didn't have that when I was 18, when I was the same age as Ivy. So I think that there's kind of two levels there. There's a sort of, I guess, more like activist stance there that I have, that, that we shouldn't assume that all characters are neurotypical unless told otherwise, but also the fact that Ivy definitely wouldn't know that about herself. And I think that hopefully that kind of comes through in other ways, like you mentioned there. And I certainly have had a lot of neurodivergent readers really connect with her. And on the flip side, some neurotypical readers not really get her, and that's fine too.
I wanted other friends, another world outside of the one I'd grown up in. I wanted newness and novelty, to push at the boundaries of my life and stretch it a little. And if I hadn't wanted that, if I'd just stuck close to what I knew, then I wouldn't be forcing myself further into the water, sharp rocks jagging into me. The icy numbness feels like a punishment. A punishment for not valuing what I had. I search for her hair, the hard-to-contain frizz that I've plaited a million times. I search for her fingertips, reaching for me like they do whenever we dance. I search for her arms so that I can pull her to me, hug her, promise that we'll never be apart again. That I'll make every choice based around her, that I won't go away next academic year. But there's nothing. The waves come and they go, crashing against my legs, but give me no clues.
And more from Elspeth Wilson in a moment. But now, let's take a visit to the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. The next in the popular Canon Clement series by Richard Cole is A Death on Location, and it was donated by WNN.
As she left the picture gallery, the Queen staggered slightly. She had to lean against the wall for a moment to get her balance and her breath back. She hoped no one saw, for poise was everything. Hard enough in such unforgiving dress, laced in, huge-skirted, wigged and head-dressed. But the mask was magnificent, and she on display and in service to her glory. To encourage the other ladies to join in with it, she had danced and danced and danced, so much so that she developed a horrible stitch and was forced to stop. The other dancers were still going strong. How the hell did people manage, so brutally corseted, if you got a stitch or a cramp or an itch?
It's spring 1990, and in Champon, the whole village is aflutter as a glamorous Hollywood movie has taken over Lord de Fleur's Champon House as its set location. As the actors and extras hired from the village don their farthingales, gowns and crowns for a mask set in the 1600s, a murder interrupts filming on set, and it's an ingenious one. Can Daniel solve the mystery with the help of his sidekick, Detective Sergeant Neil Van Loo, even when things are so sticky between them?
She recovered, gathered herself, and swished along the corridor past more portraits of different queens, of duchesses and marchionesses done up in magnificent displays. Hers was not only magnificent but fantastical, for she was costumed as Candace, Queen of the Ethiopians. Fantastical and improbable, for she thought it unlikely in antiquity to have glided along the banks of the Gihon in a gorgeously embroidered bodice and billowing silks. Behind her, the lights from chandeliers and stanchions flickered, and the sound of flutes and voices and the stamp of feet faded. She had managed the courant, recovered in the saraband, but halfway through the jig, the stitch had suddenly afflicted her. No wonder, she thought, when your viscera were crammed into an unnatural hourglass by laces and whalebone. And it wasn't just the ladies. One of the lords, the Earl of somewhere, she wasn't sure where, had complained that he'd only just managed to button his doublet. She leant once again on the wood-panelled wall. The stitch was agony, her feet hurt, pinched in a sort of dancing slipper the costumier had thought suggestive of the topaz palaces of Ethiopia. And she had a headache coming on that felt like it might soon oblige her to take to her bed. But first, she needed to get out of her dress. She ran, half-staggered, down a plainer corridor towards the great house's kitchens and sculleries. She was gasping when she pushed open the door. The occupant of that humble room turned to face her, startled, and two spots of pink flushed on her cheeks. "Miss March," said the Queen, "could you be a pal and pop me a Nurofen?"
A Death on Location, Book 4 of the Canon Clement series by Richard Coles, is read by the author and runs for 8 hours 30 minutes.
The Cardinal by Alison Weir was given to us by Headline.
Tom was trying to concentrate. All around him, boys, most of them 15, 4 years older than he, were busy at their studies, but he was distracted by the noise of building works going on beyond the mullioned windows, and it was hard to drag his attention back to the Latin translation on which he was supposed to be labouring, for he was too busy thinking about the construction of the new buildings, and wondering how such a project would be managed. How did one get all those men and materials in the right place at the right time? But the approach of the master, beak-nosed, cane in hand, had him bending, squinting to his book, and vigorously dipping his quill in the inkwell. The master paused, peering over his shoulder, then nodded and passed along the form, presumably seeking out other victims. Tom had already seen how quick he was to lash out with that cane.
It begins with young Tom Wolseley, the bright and brilliant son of a Suffolk tradesman sent to study at Oxford at just 11 years old. It ends with a disgraced cardinal, cast from the king's side and estranged from the woman he loves. The years in between tell the story of a scholar and a lover, a father and a priest. From the court of Henry VIII, Tom builds a powerful empire of church and state. At home in London, away from prying eyes, he finds joy in a secret second life. But when King Henry, his treasured friends, demands the ultimate sacrifice, what will Wolseley choose?
His translation was soon finished, but the other boys were still scratching away with their quills. Tom pretended to be reading over the passage, but in reality he was deciphering the graffiti carved into the desk, doubtless by past pupils steeped in misery. Learning, he thought, should be a pleasure, but the prospect of 4 years of this stern regime was daunting. He had been so thrilled to be awarded a place at Oxford, had fallen in love at first sight with the city, its ornate colleges, its quads and spires, and its teeming student population. He had yearned with a passion to delve deep into its famous libraries and immerse himself in the knowledge of centuries. But now he felt that the vibrant life of the university was passing him by, and he wondered if he would ever truly be a part of it. The day yawned ahead. It was not yet 7 o'clock, when they would all troop meekly to daily mass, which would no doubt be followed by an interminable sermon exhorting them to virtuous behaviour. Then there would be lectures until commons, where the fare was invariably beef broth, pottage and weak ale, and after that private study or tutorials until bed, which was at 8 o'clock in winter and 9 o'clock in summer. It was like being in a monastery, although monks and friars probably had more freedom.
The Cardinal by Alison Weir is read by Nick Biaden and runs for 16 hours and 27 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now more from my chat with Elspeth Wilson. The audio version of our book, These Mortal Bodies, is read by Kirsty Isla McIntyre.
After a while, maybe 10 minutes, maybe an hour, I'm so cold that my body walks me back to the shore before my brain can do anything about it. I rip off my soaking underwear and change back into my skirt and top, the fabric clinging to my damp skin. They're far too thin and flimsy for the beach. Even in the week after school finished, what should be the height of summer. But I wanted to wear something pretty when I went to the pub with Jenny and Aaron, and maybe even some of the boys too. I thought Cara would compliment me on my carefully selected outfit, rather than laugh at my desire to be liked by the people who at best ignored us. That want, desperate, pouring off of me like sweat. I should have followed her as she laughed and walked away. That scorn a kind of invitation too. I just didn't realise it at the time as I cursed her retreating body to feel the same kind of bodily hurt as I did at her rejection.
How did you structure the novel?
Yeah, so the novel, I guess it was kind of a little bit easy for me, which I'm definitely struggling with more now that I'm writing my second novel, because the structure almost felt like it was handed to me because it's set largely over the course of this 1 year that Ivy has over her first year of university. The fact that I am, that, you know, there's this term structure was quite helpful to me. There are three terms in the book, and there's each term has 8 weeks. So there's sort of 8 chapters within each of these three sections of the book. And I really wanted each term to have a different feel to it. So the first term is very seductive, I hope, and kind of Ivy's being enticed into this world and she's very much learning about it. And then the second term is like her kind of trying to solidify the status, but things are maybe getting a bit pulled from under her feet. And the third term is really hot and sticky because it takes place in the summer. So I think that kind of structure of having these three clear terms with three clear feelings and atmospheres really helped me. And then I guess the other point to mention in terms of structure is there's a historical subplot which I drew inspiration from the North Berwick witch trials, which runs throughout the novel. And there's a vignette from this voice of woman from the past who kind of acts the chorus that appears at the start of each chapter. So there's these kind of two timelines going on at the same time. Very much the thrust of the novel is the contemporary timeline, but there is also this other piece which builds and eventually ends up connecting with the main timeline as well that happens at the start of each chapter.
Now, I know you've done a lot of writing in the past, poetry and writing for publication as well, but what was the inspiration behind these mortal bodies? How did the idea for Ivy's story begin?
I started writing this novel in 2020, literally just before the start of lockdown. So I started writing it in beginning of February 2020. And really, I think the inspiration was the fact that I was quite lonely even before lockdown and the COVID pandemic, which obviously heightened that feeling as I was quite isolated at the time. And I really was keen to inhabit a world where friendship was very much at the heart of it, because for better or worse, and there's obviously some quite toxic elements to the friendship in the novel, is very much a novel about this kind of trinity at the heart of it, this trinity of friends who live kind of very much on top of each other in this collegiate university and in this college. And I think I was feeling quite atomized, quite apart from community. I was in a grad job I really didn't enjoy. I'd moved to London and didn't really know that many people there, and I was finding it quite challenging. And I really wanted to kind of inhabit that world where community is everything. So the inspiration from the novel came from basically two directions. I definitely had the characters of Ivy, Primrose and Martha very much in my head from the start, and also the setting. I really wanted to write something set at a campus university, set at a collegiate university. I was always loved the secret history when I was at university myself, which is obviously kind of one of the founding texts of campus novel and dark academia genres. And yeah, I think then when the pandemic happened and we went into lockdown, I had some more time to write because I didn't have my commute anymore, which I think is why so many people were able to write their novel that they'd been thinking about for a while during the pandemic. And also, but it wasn't just that, it was the fact that that loneliness that I already mentioned, that isolation, was heightened. So I just really wanted to escape further into this world, which yes, absolutely has darker aspects, but has kind of so much friendship and community within it as well.
And it's your debut novels. How did it go from manuscript on your PC to being in the shops?
So it was a long journey, but maybe not as long as some people have. I think having talked to other writers, I feel like it's not been particularly fast journey, not been particularly slow, kind of just been around average. I worked on the novel on my own for quite a long time, a number of years. So I wrote the first draft in 15-minute chunks because I was a carer for a family member at the time. So I didn't really have a lot of free time. And all I kind of really had was 15 minutes a day where I put my timer on and just literally bashed out the first draft in those 15-minute chunks. Then the editing process, I needed a lot more time for that, and that was a lot slower. But I got some input from a writing friend called Anna Britton, who's a crime writer who wrote a book called A Shot in the Dark. And she kind of offered some advice, which was really helpful in terms of guiding the next few iterations. And then I kind of stumbled through a few iterations of the manuscript on my own before I started working with my agent, Caro Clark, who runs Portobello Literary Agency. And they really helped me kind of get to the heart of the novel and really figure out, yeah, the kind of final structure and help hone that. I suppose something which should maybe say is that I got my agent in a little bit of an unusual way, because I mentioned that the manuscript wasn't finished there. And that is quite an unusual way of getting an agent, but I had previously been shortlisted for the Nan Shepherd Prize when Caro was working at Canongate, which is a nature writing prize for underrepresented writers. And because of that, Caro already knew my work. So then when I reached out to them and said I was looking for representation for my novel, they were already aware of me and knew that they liked my writing. And then from there, we worked on it quite a bit again together. So I think it probably went through something like 15 or 16 drafts before copy edits and proofreading right at the end. So it really was redrafted a lot, and it came out in July. So it was just over 5 years really from the start of sitting down and writing it to being able to share it with readers.
And you've also found a little community of other debut writers.
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that's one of the main things that has been so joyful and special to me in this debut year. The support of other debut writers has just been amazing, and we do quite a lot of body doubling sessions online to work on our second novel, like in a WhatsApp group called Second Novel Bootcamp, which is just so helpful. And I think that's something that if anyone is listening who's interested in writing, that's one of the things that I would, you know, one of my number one writing tips would be to try and find writing community. And that can look different for different people. It can very much be online. My writing community is pretty much solely based online. But I think that whatever stage you're at, it really, really helps. It can be quite lonely. There can be tough moments, lots of ups and downs, both in creativity and in the publishing industry, which are obviously two separate but interconnected things. So yeah, just seeing other writers as your community and your peers rather than competition, I think just makes everything so much richer and has just been, yeah, a real joy building friendships with other writers.
I'm pulling my beat up trainers back on when I hear a shriek. In that second, I know. It seemed like there was almost no one on the beach apart from me, the mum and the toddler. But now people are coming from all corners to congregate at the shoreline. Someone's pointing out to sea. Someone's on their phone. Another is holding me back as I'm hurling myself forward without even thinking about it. A man pulls his shirt off and runs into the water, wading, then swimming, his arms strong and powerful. I envy the muscles that propel him, interlaced with his confidence, the sinew and attitude that make him so certain of rescue. I want to move forward, but I can't. I feel nothing until I see her. Seaweed sticking to her hair like a grotesque crown. And then I feel everything. Too much. Every feeling that exists under this thin, watery sun all at once. And then nothing again. The only option against a flood so big, I'm drowning.
Now, we heard in the introduction and during the interview clips of the book narrated by Kirsty Ilja McIntyre. Did you have any hand in the casting of her as the voice of Ivy?
A little bit. So I was asked to write a brief for the actor who was going to be selected. So that was kind of involved things like playing age, accent, whether, you know, the actor would have to do lots of different characters and that kind of thing. And I provided some specifications, and then I was sent a few clips back, and it was just immediately obvious to me as soon as I listened to Kirsty's clips and the other books. I had to listen to some of the other books she's narrated. It just felt like, yeah, a really great fit. And I think like she's just done such a good job, and I'm glad that I was able to have a bit of input, I suppose, because it was quite important to me that Ivy was Scottish. So it was that she was played by a Scottish actor, or the book was narrated by a Scottish actor. But yeah, I think it's one of these things where it's probably a bit hard to know exactly who you're looking for as a writer. But then when you hear it, you could just tell who's the right fit for your story. Even though I do think that listening to an audiobook of a book you wrote, it brings it alive in a different way, I think, because obviously the actor will have their own interpretation of the reading and their own narration. So that's been quite cool as well, to be able to hear a scene quite differently than it sounded in my head, but so much more sort of alive and dramatic.
It was recorded at the R&IB Talking Book Studios. Did you manage to go along and see any of the recording?
I did not, but I do know that other authors who have managed to go along and said that it was really special. So I'm definitely sad that I didn't, but I mean, the first time I heard it, I was just like, this is so cool, because the sample came up on my Spotify even before I got sent the full file, which I didn't know about. And I was like, it was one of those moments where I was just so excited.
The audio version's out there now, so it's available for anyone for whatever reason, dyslexia, disability, blindness, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Absolutely, I definitely think so. I mean, my earliest reading experiences were 100% through audiobooks. I'm quite a slow reader. It's definitely something that sometimes can be a little bit challenging as an author, especially now that I'm getting asked to blurb books. I think something that I would like to see more of in the industry is audiobook proofs and audiobooks being available earlier, so that people who need audiobooks or prefer audiobooks for whatever reason can access them, at the same time that you might have an early reader copy in print. And yes, when I was growing up, I was saying just there that audiobooks, they really, all my sort of literary memories from before the age of about 12, most of them are through audiobooks, partly because, as I say, I'm a really slow reader and that was a much easier way for me to read. And partly because I think audiobooks, yes, obviously they're extremely important for accessibility, and that's something that's very close to my heart and that I always try and champion in my work in terms of accessibility. But also, I think that they feel quite akin to the oral storytelling tradition. And I used to listen to audiobooks with my parents. We used to listen to them on car journeys and things. And I think they can have that kind of community sense to them as well. So, for a whole multitude of reasons, it's incredibly important to me. And my first book that was published was called Too Hot to Sleep, and it's a poetry book. And that doesn't have an audiobook, partly because it was just published by a very small great publisher called Written Off Publishing, but who just a lot of small publishers don't have the budget to produce audiobooks. But I would definitely be interested in just, I guess if, the quality probably wouldn't be super high, but doing the best that I could in terms of just recording it myself at home. Because yeah, I think that every book out there should have an audiobook, and that's something that I will always definitely aim for and strive for in future work as well.
I was going to say, does that oral tradition come from your poetry background? Because some poems are just meant to be read out loud.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I definitely think that some of my poems, like they feel like I can, they feel like they can equally work on the page or being read out loud. And then sometimes, yeah, I've written one and I'm like, oh, I think that, yeah, that just feels like it needs to be said out loud. And I think, as you mentioned there, it's like there's such a link between poetry and sort of the oral storytelling tradition that it feels sad to me that we do see a lot less poetry audiobooks, I think. Like, I find that quite rare to see a poetry audiobook. And I think that is partly because there's no money in poetry. So the poetry scene, is often run out of passion and commitment. Like Rebecca Kenny, who runs Written Off Publishing, she's just a very committed person who massively cares about poetry and uplifting marginalized voices. But I think, in the poetry scene, there just aren't as many audiobooks. I guess there's a lot of live poetry events which center, yeah, speech and performance. But I think it would be great to see more poetry audiobooks in the poetry scene. Even if, as I say, they were kind of DIY, I still think that would be better than nothing, and that would be something. And I also think for myself, sometimes I read a poem, but I would love to know what it would sound like with the poet performing it, as well. I think that that is offers, especially in poetry, it's can it just, yeah, offers something else as well.
And you've worked with Disability Arts Online, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've written a few things for Disability Arts Online. I think they are reviewing These Mortal Bodies, and they did review my pamphlet Too Hot to Sleep as well. But I've also written reviews of other people's work for them. Just recently I wrote a review of the Dan Dore Show, which was a show in the Edinburgh International Festival exploring disability and sexuality. And I was also the Disability Arts Online and Edward Morgan Trust Poetry Associate Artist in 2024, which basically involved me getting some seed funding to explore an idea that I had about exploring Selkie mythology and masking and the different parts of our identity that we might be asked to excise and minimize and mask by society and by loved ones. And the result of that is I made a poetry film called Skin, which is it's a visual film, but I also read the poem during the film, and there's a lot of auditory effects there as well. I filmed a lot at the beach. It's very much kind of a poem imagining this character of the Selkie having had their skin stolen from them by their human lover, as is so often the case in the folktale, and using that as a platform to kind of imagine how that would feel, having this aspect of yourself stolen by someone that you love. There's a lot of water imagery, but it's a poem in three parts, what's called an erasure poem. So the first poem is the full poem, and then the second one, some parts of it have been erased, and then the third one, even more, has been erased, to kind of explore the erasure of this character who I'm imagining's identity and think about coercive control as well.
Skin. One. It starts with him telling me it's my own good. He took my skin, just for a little bit, because he knows I've been having a difficult time of late and it wouldn't be right, not for anyone, for me to go wandering off. Don't I know that he loves me? Don't I know that this is harder for him than it is for me when he sees me cry because I know the only salt water I'll be able to touch is that of my own making? Two. It starts. For my own good. Just for a little bit. Not for anyone. He loves me? This is harder for him than it is for me. The only salt water. Touch is that of my own making. Three. It starts good. Just a bit. He loves harder. For me, cry, salt water, touch, my own.
That was a really interesting project because I'd never made a poetry film before, but I was really proud of it. And again, mentioned the sort of DIY nature of the poetry scene earlier, and that felt very DIY in the sense that I was doing all the filming myself with my little tripod that cost like £15, and really learning about how to do video editing and things, these things that I didn't know before. But it was really interesting from a writing and artistic perspective, because it kind of reminded me that you don't have to be writing in a particular genre or even a particular form. You can just experiment with where your kind of creativity takes you and what you're called towards. And it was just a reminder to be playful and experiment. So I'm really grateful for my time working with Disability Arts Online for that.
Right, we mentioned this way back at the start. One thing we'll miss if we download the audio version of These Mortal Bodies from the R&B library or anywhere else is the cover. Can you give us a quick description of the cover of the book?
Yeah, so the cover is a bright pink cover with a black Gothic building with kind of these crenellated spires pushing upwards towards a slightly cloudy sky. And across the building, in the centre of the building, there's a series of white birds that are flying in front of it, a kind of flock of birds. I am not a bird watcher, so I could not say exactly what these birds are meant to be, but they look like they might be have the same kind of silhouette and size as potentially crows or some kind of mid-sized bird. And then in white text, which is slightly, yeah, I would say it's kind of a slightly Gothic font, not that I'm a font specialist, but it feels quite Gothic to me, says These Mortal Bodies, and above that in black, my name, Elspeth Wilson. And then below, in a more modern font, it says, there's a tagline which says, she wasn't born into their world, but she'll do anything to belong.
These Mortal Bodies is available in print as an ebook and an audio commercially. And Elspeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the conversation, Robert. It was so interesting. And yeah, I just really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you.
These Mortal Bodies by Elspeth Wilson is available in audio commercially now and is on its way to the RNIB library and should be there in a few weeks' time.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And now a return to Elspeth Wilson for the Books of My Life.
So was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
It's kind of hard to pinpoint one book because, as I said, audiobooks were a huge part of my childhood and I listened to audiobooks every single night before bed, the point where I had this little mini cassette player and all the keys had fallen off at the top, so I used to just have to press in the little bits of metal instead. My mum and I were talking about this book series, which is like a really sort of like old 80s book series called Pong Whiffy, A Witch of Dirty Habits by a writer called Kay Umansky. And I haven't listened to this since I was a child, so I don't know how it aged, but I really do remember this audiobook having had a huge impact on me, just in terms of like feeling like it was so fun and I was so immersed in this world. So yeah, I think that there were a few other books like that. I think I listened to a lot of the kind of classics like The Secret Seven and The Famous Five on audiobook as well. And I maybe can't pinpoint one specifically, but they all kind of gave me this sense of total immersion in the world. I remember, you know, like dreading my parents coming up the stairs to say it was bedtime and I had to turn the book off before bed. And I think that that book I mentioned there, Pong Whiffy, and also the Worst Witch series as well, which I listened to when I was a child, those ones in particular, I was always quite interested in witches. And I think that was partly because thinking about the Worst Witch, you know, it was often kind of misfits and outcasts, both as a kind of class, I guess, of witches being these kind of outcasts, but then specifically within that, within the Worst Witch, this girl who sort of feels kind of like uncomfy and a bit weird and a bit odd everywhere. And I definitely massively related to that too. And that probably was probably like a time where I sort of realized like, okay, like girls who are weird can actually be these really compelling characters.
Witch Shark Adam, my old friend, cried Witch Pong Whiffy, opening the front boulder with her very best welcoming smile firmly fixed in place. What a lovely surprise. Welcome to my humble cave. My, you do look nice. Is that a new hairdo, or have you had some sort of terrible shock? Ha ha ha! Just my little joke. Come in. Let me take your hat. She seized the tall hat, gave it a respectful little brush, and waited until Shark Adder's back was turned before booting it into a dark corner. It's hardly a surprise if you knew I was coming, remarked Sharkadder coldly, advancing into the cave. I know you want to be my friend again, Pong Whiffy, but I'm not at all sure I want to be yours, so stop putting it on. There was no doubt that Pong Whiffy was being revoltingly smarmy, but it was for a good reason. You see, she and Sharkadder were usually best friends, but they had recently had one of their quarrels, and Pong Whiffy was anxious to make amends. Oh, you're not still thinking about that silly old quarrel, are you? Come on, Sharky, let bygones be bygones. Have a look at my new cave. I only moved in last week. You're my first guest. Sharkadder stared around distastefully. Pong Whiffy's cave wasn't a pleasant sight. It had shocking damp problems, for a start. Slimy green moss grew on the walls, and the floor was a sea of muddy puddles. The broken-down furniture wasn't so much arranged as thrown in, any old how. Thick black steam belched from the horrible-looking slop, which bubbled and glopped in the cauldron. "Well, sit down, Sharky, make yourself at home," fussed Pong Whiffy, removing Sharkadder's cloak and dropping it into a slimy pool. "There's nowhere to sit," observed Sharkadder truthfully. "You'll have to use that cardboard box. I haven't sorted the chairs out yet. That's the trouble when you've just moved in. It takes ages to get organised, doesn't it?" "You've never been organised," said Sharkadder. "What's that terrible stink? Smells like dead skunk." "It is," said Pong Whiffy cheerfully. "It's tonight's supper, my speciality. You'll love it. Skunk stew. I'll just give it a stir." And she took a large ladle and poked at the heaving goo in the cauldron. "Oh," said Sharkadder, wishing she'd stayed at home. "Skunk stew, really?" "I knew you'd be pleased," said Pong Whiffy. "Now tell me truthfully, How do you like the cave? It's a little damp, I know, and perhaps a bit small, but it was very cheap. Of course, it's a nuisance being in goblin territory, but I can't afford anything better at the moment. What do you think of it? It's a dump, said Sharkadder. It's a smelly little slum. It's not fit to live in. It's squalid and yucky. It's the worst cave I've ever been in. It suits you. Does, doesn't it? Agreed Pong Whiffy, pleased. I feel it's me. It's a pity about the goblins, though. I'll tell you about them later. Now then, how much stew for you, Sharky?
About half a teaspoon, said Sharkadder hastily. I had a huge lunch, and I think I've got a touch of tummy trouble, and I'm slimming.
Nonsense, said Pong Whiffy, relentlessly approaching with a huge, greasy plateful. Get that down, you. You don't need to slim. You're beautifully thin. You can model rags with that figure. And that's a lovely perfume you're wearing. Don't tell me. Let me guess. Night in a fish factory, right? And I do so like the new hairstyle. It really suits you. Brings out the beakiness of your nose.
Does, doesn't it? Agreed Sharkadder, finally coming round after such an onslaught of flattery. She scrabbled in her bag, took out a small cracked hand mirror, and examined the frazzled mess with satisfaction.
I've got some new hair rollers, she explained. Little hedgehogs, you warm them up. Not too much or they get bad-tempered and nip. Just enough to send them to sleep. Then you wind the hair around and wait for them to cool. And it comes out all curly like this.
Beautiful, nodded Pong Whiffy through a mouthful of stew.
You always look so nice, Sharky. I don't know how you do it.
That's Prunella Scales, reading from A Witch of Dirty Habits, book one in the Pong Whiffy series by Kay Umansky, all of which are available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, I think for me, poetry is what I would turn to on a rainy day and reread. There's a book called Pamper Me to Hell and Back by a poet called Hira Lindsey Bird that I would just kind of like return to again and again. It's the book that I often give as a gift to friends as well. And I think something that I really love about it is how much it kind of takes pop culture as an inspiration and, you know, uses these things which are often derided in culture as kind of frivolous or often in a kind of gendered way seen as not very important, and uses things like, for example, Friends, the sitcom, to explore these really deep emotions. But being a slow reader, I think that it's quite a tall order for me sometimes to reread longer books. It'll take me a really long time to read it in the first place. So definitely for books that I return to again and again, I tend to find them to be either poetry or short stories or essay collections.
Unfortunately, there's no audio version of Pamper Me to Hell and Back by Hira Lindsey Bird, although you can hear her reading from her books of poetry on YouTube. And is there a book you've read recently? Doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, I'm reading, well, it's a reread actually, but I would definitely recommend it. Letters to My Weird Sisters by Joanne Lindberg, which is basically Joanne picking these four characters who are real women from history who are, she's not going back into the past and diagnosing them as autistic because that's not something that you can't do, but they're women that she feels this kind of weird kinship with, and writing letters to them to explore gender and autism and neurodiversity and the idea of weirdness or never quite fitting in. And I just find it to be such a beautiful book, and I really enjoy Joanne's writing, which I find to be like challenging and makes me think and feels very intellectual but very accessible at the same time.
Dear listener, you may have heard of Uncanny Valley. It's the term game designers, animators, and animatronic designers use to refer to the uncomfortable feeling you get when you encounter a representation of a human figure that isn't quite human enough to convince, but is, at the same time, so very nearly human that the resemblance seems to call the lines between human, not human, and fake, real, into question. For some reason, human beings set a lot of store by the distinction between ourselves and everything else that exists, and it makes us uncomfortable when we can't locate it clearly. We call that feeling of discomfort, of something's being subtly but indescribably off, the feeling of uncanniness, from the German Unheimlichkeit, which literally means unhomelike, unsettled. We prefer a thing to be either familiar or strange, so that we know whether to welcome it or treat it with suspicion. When we're faced with the strangely familiar, we don't know how we're supposed to react. Freud didn't formulate the concept of the uncanny. That was the German psychiatrist, Ernst Jentsch. But he explored it in some detail in one of his best-known papers, where he defined it as an aesthetic experience, the subjective impression belonging to the person who encounters the unsettling object. You can read work on this experience of uncanniness in all kinds of journals on all kinds of subjects. You'll probably have come across it, for example, in connection with ghost stories or horror films or photography. We know a lot about how it feels to encounter the uncanny. We don't talk so much about how it feels to embody it, but it does happen. I'm pretty sure that everyone, at some time, has the experience of being uncanny. I'm also fairly sure that, for most people, their experiences are rare, fleeting one-offs. Maybe you met a distant relative at a family event, and they thought for a moment that they were looking at your parent at the same age. Maybe you were drunk or otherwise intoxicated in a way that made other people uneasy around you. Maybe you found yourself briefly among strangers who didn't have a way of reading you. Maybe you simply appeared for a moment at a time and in a place where the appearance of a person of your type was entirely unexpected.
Letters to My Weird Sisters on Autism and Feminism by Joanne Lindbergh is available commercially as read by Jennifer Smith. And once again, Elspeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I really hope that listeners enjoy this. And if you want to reach out and say hi, I'm on Instagram at Elspeth Wright.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.